Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Tonight we start the group retreat to start the winter retreat for this year. And so this group meditation retreat will carry on till the 18th, I think. So from the 7th to the 18th. So it's a time for us to wind down. Seems very hard for some people to wind down, I guess because this is quite a busy place, there's a lot to do and then there's a lot of rushing about to do before the winter retreat starts to get things finished. And so it's quite difficult if you've been rushing about and trying to achieve lots of small jobs, things, just to stop and then become quiet. It's not that easy. I think we've all experienced this. But we'll have this formal period over this time, over the next 10 days or so. And this should help people just to sort of settle down. So do your best just to try to keep with the program as we've made it out, and then just try to settle the mind, become more quiet, so that at the end of the 10 days you can have the rest of the retreat in a much more quieter mode. It's a good time for the monastics because the weather often doesn't really encourage a great deal of physical activities. It's cold or it's raining. Last year we had a lot of rain in January. Everywhere was wet and soggy. So it was quite nice to stay in. And so this winter time, the time of the winter when the weather isn't so pleasant, perhaps for moving about outside, is a good time for us to stay in and to meditate, do some meditation or some contemplation. We can't make it just be what we want it to be. Of course, when we think of a meditation retreat, then immediately the mind starts to figure out how a meditation retreat should be and what the results of it should be, and then we project that onto it. But often there's those of us that have done it before, a number of times, know that it's very often it isn't like that. That's just more of our own proliferation. It's more of our own preferences, views and opinions. Actually, the reality is often not as we think it should be. Then there's a tendency in the mind then to think, oh, it's some sort of a failure. This is no good. Is it worth doing it? And things like this. But that's just because we're clinging to some ideas of what we would like to achieve, what we want to achieve over this 10 days. And that, of course, comes from the worldly mind, the mind of society, which encourages us always to see ourselves as in terms of achievement, what we are achieving. So being as I'm a senior monk here, not by choice, but by, not quite sure how I managed to get to be the senior monk here actually, for this winter retreat. But it's interesting to see, a lot of people seem to think that it's my winter retreat and everything that happens is either my fault or it's my desire for it to happen, if I have some sort of ambition. I'm just another monk that's living who happens to be the senior monk and therefore but will have certain duties and certain commitments to fulfill, but just doing the winter retreat with everybody else, it's not my winter retreat no more than it's anyone else's. It's all of our winter retreats. And what we make of it is, of course, up to ourselves. We can all help each other because we all have different skills and we all have different abilities. And so we can all help each other, really, during the winter retreat. Obviously, some people will have some more duties than others, but that's okay. But if we take it, we tend to take everything on such a personal level, on such an ambitious level, on such an achieving level. And if we take ownership or it becomes my responsibility or this sort of thing. But often then this is what leads us into these ideas of having failed or not achieving what we want to achieve or there's something wrong. But actually the winter retreat itself will just be what it is. And I've done a few winter retreats here, not as many as some of you, but I've always noticed that they're never at the end of it, when I look back at it, it's never been what I thought it was going to be at the beginning. It's always very, very different. And if I was to hold to any idea of what you know, that it should be like this, and I should achieve that, and I should get that, and I should be like this at the end of it, namely enlightened, then it's always been very disappointing. So I try not to hold to those ideas anymore. Nonetheless, whether it's going to be what we want it to be or not, it doesn't really matter too much. What matters is that we bring ourselves into the present moment and we use the time that we've got to our own advantage we use it in the best way we can to advance in our life as monks and nuns, lay people, interested in developing the spiritual life more than the worldly life, more than the ordinary life of things, more than just the ordinary way, calculated way of living, but it's more the renunciant way of letting things be and just responding to the moment. This is the way to live really in the monastery, responding to whatever the moment brings for us, whether it's the moment of relationships, whether it's the moment of retreats, the moment of work, is to respond in the way that leads us to this place of liberation, where we can just let go of those attachments. Often it's in things, extreme things. So you can say a retreat time for many people is quite extreme because they find it quite difficult to be on their own. Meditation isn't so easy, and then there's lots of time just to watch, to be aware of the mind playing its tricks. And so for some people, a time of retreat, it can be seen as an extreme time. It's in extreme times that actually show us what are the strong tendencies, mental tendencies. But of course we want to use this next 10 days. The idea of this 10 days is that we sit, we have specific sitting times, we come and sit together, supporting each other in this way. So just as in all endeavours in the human realms, it brings in these two factors of community and individuality. Because let's face it, when we sit down and close our eyes, then it's totally individual. What's going on in your mind, I don't know. I only know what's going on in my mind. I only know what my meditation is like. I don't know what yours is like. So then I have to look after that. I have to take responsibility for that. I have to take responsibility for my practice in that way. I have to take responsibility for my own liberation, if that's going to be, and each individual meditation is my responsibility to make the best of that time, to meditate in the best way I can. And it's not on an individual level, so I have to look to that to see what is good for me, what is best for me on those terms. But then when we have a retreat time like this, then we do come and sit together. We say, okay, at certain times we will all come to the hall and meditate, or at certain times we will all come to the hall and do chanting. Certain times we'll do sitting, certain times we'll have a meal, certain times we'll have walking meditation, and this, then it becomes, the communal element then becomes obvious to us. So we all say, we make a commitment then to, yes, okay, we'll all do it together, so we'll all meditate, instead of meditating separately in our rooms or wherever we meditate. Yes, okay, we'll all come to the sala and we'll meditate at this time for 3/4 of an hour together. So when we do that, then it's a way of supporting each other. And this is the communal aspect of our life. We have this individual aspect where we have to take responsibility for our own practice on the level, on that level. And then we have a communal responsibility of helping each other. And of course, the way that we help each other is by coming together at the right times, parting at the right times, and doing our best just to be, say, keep the silence and to keep to the routines that we have designated that we'd like to do for these next 10 days. And of course, on an individual level, we're all different, and so some people find meditation quite easy to do. Some people find contemplation easy to do, and some people find meditation, contemplation, anything where they have to sit and watch the mind or put forth an effort to still or quiet the mind or just watch. They find that quite difficult. It's not a pleasant experience for them to do. So we are all very different on that level. So again, it becomes our own responsibility then to find a way on the individual level of how to use this time that is best for us, so that we gain some useful aspects of our practice from this time. So some people might experience nice, peaceful, deep meditation, some people won't, but that's just the way things are for us. So we're having each day we have the morning puja starting at 5, and it would be good if everyone can come at 5 to start the puja. 5 o'clock's not a popular time in the morning, especially on a cold winter's morning. And I guess that all becomes part of the practice, doesn't it? Is actually to get ourselves up and to get out into the cold and to come to the sala. This all becomes part of our determination and our commitment, really. If we don't do it for ourselves, then we do it to be part of the group. So we can use this individual and the communal aspects to encourage ourselves. And then after breakfast, we have the meeting at half past eight, doing 3/4 of an hour sitting, 3/4 of an hour walking. We like to do walking meditation. Then 3/4 of an hour sitting, and then the meal time. And it's good to remember also in this time that the meal time is also a meditation for us. Actually, meal times are always supposed to be meditation for monastics, but as we all know, they're very often not. But still, in this maybe in this 10 time, we can make a little bit of effort to make our meal times a little bit more meditative, quiet, and just spending the time watching the mind instead of wagging the tongue. And then after the meal we start again and have sessions in the afternoon, sitting and walking until tea time, and then the evening puja, finishing probably 9 o'clock or somewhere at 9:30 or whatever, depending on whether there's a talk. So this is not a harsh schedule. If we was in Burma, we would be all leaping out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and being in the sala by 4, and you'd be in the sala meditating all day till about 9:30. So this is quite gentle compared to a lot of places. So this is, but it's good for us to reflect on this, to recognize that as part of our practice, there is this individual effort, individual responsibility, but there's also our responsibility and our effort for the community, helping each other. And with the meditation then, starting in the morning meditation, some people find morning meditation good. We call them morning people. And some people find morning meditation dreadful. We call them evening people. But whether you're a morning person or an evening person, we have to find a way. This is a secret of meditation, is it? Is to find our skillful means and finding a way that we can use all meditation sessions, whether they're comfortable for us or not, for a way of using them for our own advantage on the level. So ways we can use meditation times, say in the morning, if you find that you're a drowsy sort of person, and that say watching the breath or the doing Lumbar's sound of silence is quite a sort of meditation that tends to make you feel even more sleepy. With the breath is it's a very refined and quiet sort of meditation, and it's, if you're a sleepy person in the morning, you watch the breath, that's called disaster actually, because you're bound to fall asleep. So you can use maybe other forms of where we can actually use the mind, using thought. People sometimes forget that in Buddhist meditation there is also a place for the thinking process as well, where you can use meditation times for using the mind for reflection on wholesome objects. We know in our chanting book we have these reflections at the end of the evening chanting. We have these reflections on metta, reflections on well-being, reflections on the 32 parts, reflections on the aging, the dying process, the process of karma. And so we can use these as meditations, using the mind, using thought, bringing thoughts to mind that are productive to letting go, to productive to calming the mind. So don't forget that if you do, especially in the mornings, if you do have a tendency to be drowsy, try to use some of these reflective processes to awaken the mind and to bring thoughts into the mind that will lead the mind towards a more renunciant approach, especially the metta, going through the Metta Sutta or the chanted on may I abide in well-being, the universal well-being. These, if you don't know those chants, sometimes if meditation is really difficult, if you are sleepy, then to use that time to actually practice those chants, because they have very good and wholesome concepts in them, leading us to a sense of renunciation, a sense of letting go, a sense of developing wholesome states of mind that can lead us to liberation. And so you can use these time meditation times if you find that the mind isn't really, say, wanting to stay with a refined object. You can use these meditation times to quietly go through these chants and to learn them by heart, so that you can have them at your use during the day. And once you learn some of these chants, say the Metta Sutta or the chant on well-being or the sharing of blessings, you can use them at any time of the day, wherever you are, when you're outside, you can go through them in your mind, using them in situations, instead of the mind proliferating on difficulties of life or people, or just rambling. You can begin to use these reflections as a way of holding the mind in place, holding the mind in a contemplative mood at all times. So although these times that we have, designated times, are for meditation, formal meditation, you can also use them for this way of contemplating. Purpose, using these reflections. That's what they're for. If you look at these reflections in the chanting book, you'll find some of them very useful. You can take phrases, just certain phrases from them, and just use those phrases as like a mantra or just as a very wholesome something very wholesome to hold in the mind. And that's also a type of meditation. just holding a wholesome phrase, something say from the Metta Sutta or whatever, and just holding that and just repeating it in the mind, and then the mind drifts off just like it does in all meditation and its rambling thoughts, and then just bringing it back to that phrase. That helps to keep the mind alive. It helps to bring energy to the mind, whereas watching the breath often doesn't. It often goes to the opposite way and tends to dull the mind or bring the mind to sleepiness. So sometimes in the morning, if you do have a tendency to be a sort of a sleepy pee-pee sort of person, don't forget to use thought, contemplative thought, to awaken the mind, to hold the mind on a subject or an object that is wholesome, leading to the development of wholesome qualities. The meditation period, we do it, of course we do it silently. It doesn't only mean just stilling the mind and making the mind blank or making the mind quiet. We can do that. If that is working for us, that's also very good. Watching the breath, listening to the sound of silence, this will still the mind, and then when the mind goes off, we notice, oh, we're not with the breath anymore, or not with the sound of silence. So then we can bring it back. We notice that it mirrors the thoughts that we get into, the rambling thoughts that we get into, suddenly mirrors that we're not with the sound of silence. We see the sound of silence is missing. So then we go back to it. So it's like a mirror. This is a way of stilling the mind until the mind just settles down, just simply to watch the meditation object, and then becomes very quiet and tranquil. And then this other way is a way of using thoughts to energize the mind and hold the mind on a skillful thought. So these are the two to balance each other. So no need to think of meditation time as simply stilling the mind and making the mind quiet. You have to look at the conditions as they are. It might be nice to sit down, well, sit down for an hour and have a nice peaceful mind. Then you find your mind's all over the place, full of anger. You've thought of something. You suddenly think of something that somebody did to you last year, and then the mind's full of anger for the next hour. You can't let go of it. Because just trying to let go or just trying to make an angry mind peaceful when you haven't really got the skillful means to do so can lead to a lot of frustration. And then the time's gone, and then there's a sense of disappointment. Whereas sometimes we can replace those thoughts with other thoughts, with more skillful thoughts, and lead the mind along a path, a more skillful path. If it wants to think, okay, think about something skillful. You know, walking meditation is also a good form of meditation. Obviously, we use them in this tradition that this monastery comes from, the old Thai forest tradition in Thailand. The old forest monks used to do a lot of walking meditation, but of course the climate is much more user-friendly as regards to walking meditation. Here, this very cold, I find doing walking meditation in this very cold climate is not particularly useful to me. My body doesn't like the cold very much. but we do use the walking meditation to alternate with the sitting. So if we're not used to sitting, then sitting, the back can become uncomfortable, the legs can hurt, and also we become drowsy. So to go outside and do some walking meditation is a very good alternative. It brings energy to the body, and also it can waken up the mind a bit if we have become sleepy. But in the walking meditation, also we can use that time if we're holding, say, the mind just on the footsteps or just on one point like that. We can also use that time for going through learning chanting or learning some skillful phrases that we can use, repeat in a mind, more like a contemplative process. So these two processes, a contemplative process where we're using the mind, and then the other one where we're still in the mind. Another useful method of meditation that is useful, you'll find it in the book, is the meditation on the 32 parts of the body. It's a quite interesting meditation. It breaking down the body into its bits and parts. We see ourselves as a man or a woman or young or old or whatever. This body of ours is our main, of course, our main identification. It's the thing that we identify with the most. And it's quite interesting that this identification is so strong that even though it's obvious, this body, it never does what it's told. I never told my body to get old. And it's carrying on the process, and yet I still believe that it's me. I still buy into its this identification practice. One of the teachings the Buddha did give us is to learn to break down this sense of a me, this one unit, this one being that's called me, called Ariyasila, or called various other names that people like to give it. It's just to look at all the various parts that it's made up of. This is, we call this the who am I, the who am I meditation. Who am I? Am I the hair on my head? Am I the hair on my body? Am I the nails? Who am I? Am I these teeth? Am I the flesh? Or the bones? Am I the bone marrow? Well, all of these things are all part of the body, all we identify with, especially the first five. When we look in the mirror, or we look down at ourselves, or we look at each other, what we actually see is just these the first five parts, the head, hair, body, hair, nails, teeth and skin. That's what, and then we give that a name, and then we delude ourselves that that's what we are, and that's what each one of us is. The Buddha said, well, one way you can break down this sense of identification, this sense of attachment, is to actually look at it as it really is, all bits and pieces. Some of the parts we like to own. If you've got nice pearly teeth, you like to smile, let everybody see your nice white teeth. If you've got nice blue eyes, you like people to look and see that you've got nice blue eyes. If you've got nice blonde hair or nice shiny black hair, you're happy to let people see that and identify with you at that, and that's what we like to be identified with. But we don't want anyone to see our liver. And not too many people see our hearts or our lungs. You have such beautiful lungs. Or our stomach, intestines, or our bowel. These are the things actually that we don't tend not to think about, or we wouldn't want anyone to see them or identify us as them. But they play as much a part of us as the lovely blonde hair and the beautiful blue eyes do. We need all of them to be what we are, and most of them we don't even see, we don't even want to see. We certainly don't want to see each other's, we don't even want to see our own. And so this way of asking us, well, who really am I? What am I? Who am I? Who is this identification that I have with this form? How real is that identification? Because if you think about it, in the Buddha's teachings, what are we looking for? We're really having a look in for. We're trying to have an insight into reality, not into delusion. Mostly our insights are into delusion. If you look at the world's a very deluded place, isn't it? The society in general is incredibly deluded. Deluded society. The values that we give to things in society, those things, those aspects that society gives so much value to are really very superficial. If you look at the clothes industry or the fashion industry, the cosmetics industry, the entertainment industry, how long do these things really last? They only last a short time, and then they're just thrown on the scrap heap. Well, you have to keep on repeating them over and over again, because actually they have no reality. They're just superficial things. And yet these are the values of society, Society doesn't really, in general, tend to look for that which is real. It tends to look for that which maybe satisfies us for a very short time, which is why it has to keep on repeating itself. So, but when we come to the spiritual life, it's more, we're looking for something, an insight more into that which is real, into the reality of things. What is the reality of things? The impermanent nature of things. This aspect of anatta, not self. It's there. When we say it's not self or it's impermanent, it doesn't mean to say it doesn't exist. It's there. But if we look into it, we see, well, it's not really what it seems to be. So this form, this body, this form, which I call me, or Ariasilo, or whatever else I like to call it, or anyone else wants to call it, doesn't really matter. Actually, it's not even a form. It's lots and lots of things all working, hopefully working well together. When they stop working well together, then I say I'm sick, I'm ill. But actually, there isn't any I'm there, really, is there? It's just that something isn't working well. So this sort of meditation is the one that breaks. It's helpful in breaking down this tendency for an identification. Because around this identification, of course, then comes all the mental proliferation of views and opinions and preferences. And this is where we begin to create a lot of suffering, a lot of dukkha, a lot of problems for ourselves. So these things are very much, they're interrelated. The physical and then the mental proliferation are very, very much related, and it's where we create all the difficulties is here. So with the Buddha, sometimes he points in our practice to the mind, watching the mind in the meditation, looking at the mind, looking at the way the mind proliferates, and how the self is created, how we create this self-view that we have that is so strong. And then other times he points to the physical side and says, look at that. Because actually, when we look at the physical side or the mental side, what we find is that they're always an aggregate. There isn't just a thing there called Ariasila or whatever, but there is always an aggregate or a group of things working together. So this meditation on 32 parts, then you can use that as a reflection for the meditation. That's also in the book, if you want to learn those, the monastics. It's always good for the monastics to learn this meditation. That's why we have it as one of the reflections. So it's something else you can use over the 10 days during meditation periods or other times to reflect on this, to reflect on these aspects that make us up. And of course, the meditation on the breath, one of the main meditations that we have, because the breath is that which keeps this body alive, all these bodies that we have, all so important to us. No matter who we are, or how much money we've got, no matter how many Rolls Royces we've got in the garage, or how many expensive coats or shoes or whatever we've got, in the end, this whole body, it just depends on a breath, really, doesn't it? Breath doesn't cost anything, but if you stop breathing, then all your Rolls Royces won't help you, all your bank accounts won't help you, all you need is just that one breath, and you can keep going. But without the breath, then everything dies, doesn't everything? The body dies and everything is gone. So actually it's a very important factor of our life, just this breath, watching the breath. It's like watching our life, watching the process of living. And because it's so repetitious, it comes and goes all the time. We have to breathe, we can't stop for a very short period, a matter of seconds really, and then we have to breathe again. So it's a process that goes on, and it's not something we have to do actually. If we just leave it and just watch, the body knows how to breathe. So the whole process then, the whole energy, the whole effort then becomes a process of watching, putting in the effort into developing this ability to watch, what we call mindfulness, sati, or paying attention. Sometimes we get this idea that we have to do something with the breath or breathe in a certain way, or that we actually are sort of doing the breathing. But actually, if we let go of doing the breathing and just put the attention on doing the watching, then the body will just breathe itself. It knows how to do it. It's been doing it for long enough. And this is what the Buddha's pointing to with this meditation, is just watching, observing, developing the ability to watch, developing the ability just to sit and observe using the breath, allowing the body to breathe, the breath to come, to flow, in breath, out breath, and then the effort then is just holding the attention on it. And of course, the breath isn't a very exciting meditation. It doesn't excite the mind very much. It doesn't excite my mind. And so it's very easy then for the mind to become distracted and go off into thinking. And that is what we do. That's what happens to us as human beings, especially when we start meditation, using a not particularly interesting object. The mind goes off to seek its fantasies. Now, this is one of the interesting things about doing this type of meditation, is we begin to observe what our obsessions are, actually. Most people don't really understand, don't really see or really understand just how sort of silly their minds are. But when we start to do meditation, especially on a thing like the breath or a sound of silence, these things that are just there, we don't have to do anything to make it happen, but then we can begin to see the obsessions that our mind goes into, because our minds go off into them. There's not a great deal to hold it with the breath, so it goes off into its fantasies, its states of anger or lusts or desires or wherever it's used to go into. So we can get quite a good insight into the way that we have allowed our mind to go, how we've actually trained our mind over the years, what we've trained it to dwell on. And often those things that we dwell on are not particularly wholesome. So when we do meditation, even though we can't always hold the object of attention, it's also quite useful, because we can gain quite a lot of wisdom into understanding how the mind does become conditioned by what it thinks. And what we've allowed it to think over the years, of course, is how it's become conditioned, and that's the condition we're working with now. That's why we can't just sit down and become tranquil straight away, is because, well, we haven't conditioned it to do that for many years of our life. So we begin to, but often we don't really know the paths of delusion that the mind likes to follow, because we've just been following them. And when we try to do a meditation system or a process, and we begin to see and begin to understand and get an insight into, the paths of thought that our minds we've allowed them to build up in the mind. So we can gain a lot of insight, and a lot of insight into human nature and this human condition. How things develop and grow because of conditioning. So the breath, using the breath, try making the effort to hold the breath, is a good meditation, because it teaches us a lot about the mind. And gradually, as the mind then becomes more passive, and then through the breath or through the sound of silence or through mantra, if you use mantra, then the mind can become more passive and more tranquil. You experience states of tranquility. And then during the day, as we change from these different processes, sitting meditation, walking meditation, the meal, maybe just being in our rooms or going for a walk around the field or going for a walk along the road or something, we can begin to watch the mind just in itself, without trying to hold it on a meditation object. But even as we just walk along, or if we're just walking around the back, we begin to observe the mind. Because when we try to meditate, when we practice in this way, there is a natural tendency then for us to start watching the mind for other times as well, as when we're sitting on the cushion. There's a tendency for us to develop this ability to become more contemplative of the mind, of the thinking process. And as we begin to watch the mind, develop this ability to watch the mind at other times, other than that in meditation, then we begin to see how this whole process of self, the self-view, it doesn't come from outside, it comes from inside us. It's what we create. And it's what we cling to, it's what we hold to, this view of me being this permanent person, fixed. And it's this self-view that holds us to the wheel of becoming. So we begin to see, we call it this mindfulness of Dharma. We begin to see how the thinking process, the thoughts, the perceptions, the way how we think, the thing, the conditionings that we take within us, the fact, just simply the fact that we're men or women, young or old, monks or lay or whatever, all these begin to condition us, and they create a person. So this is the view that we have of ourselves as a certain person who does this and is like this. But this personality is not one thing. Like the body, it's not one thing. It's made up of many different aspects, the mental aspects, and it's these mental and physical aspects that we can begin to observe through this mindfulness of dharmas. We begin to see how the personality view is made, is created, and then how it's clung to. So the whole of the Buddha's teaching on meditation and is to break down this sense of oneness. I am this one person. Is to break down this personality view. This is one of the first aspects that we develop, is to see, get insight into this personality view, to break down the solidity of it, so that we begin to see actually we're not a single person, but there are, you know, there's many aspects to our characters, many aspects, some wholesome, some unwholesome. And actually, in the end, we're none of it. Begin to develop this insight into this anatta, or this impermanence, permanent nature of things. Even this person, this being. It seems to be one thing, and yet it's a number of things. And even those aspects, is the number of aspects that it's made up of, even there in themselves, that if they're not permanent, they're in a constant change a process of change. Anyway, so saying this changing can't be what we are if we think about it. The sense of self, or the solidity of it, comes from, of course, its repetition. Our thinking processes tend to repeat and repeat and repeat, so they become sort of solidifiers, and it's what we believe in as ours. So this meditation then leads us to this, not just calming the mind, but then just to gain this insight into this self-view. And the mealtime, I mentioned the mealtime before, don't forget the mealtime is also a time for meditation for us, so it's another meditation period. The mealtime, we can reflect on where the food that we're eating, where that comes from. The farmers that prepare the land and sow all the grain and grow the food for us, and then the workers that work on the farm, gathering all the food in, and then the truck drivers who drive it to the shops, and the shopkeepers who run the shops, store the food, and then the people that go and buy the food, the donors, and then who come to the monastery with the food, and the people that work in the kitchen, cooking, washing up. These are all people that are contributed to our meal that we have. So as monastics, this reflection each day, this meal that I'm having today, then this comes from all these people. It doesn't come out of thin air. It's not here by right. It's not my divine right that this meal should appear for me. It comes through the hard work, graft, labour of quite a few people. There's a lot of generosity in that. Some people are providing the food, say, for wages, but other people are providing the food simply from the generosity of their hearts, from the desire to give. So there's a reflection we can have at the mealtime. Over these 10 days, we can use the mealtime as another meditation session, contemplating the food and all the people that contribute to the meal. And then developing our gratitude to those people for what is provided, because we haven't had to work to do any of it. And then put in effort to learn some chanting during this 10 days. We'll probably be chanting some suttas perhaps, or some other chants that we can start to learn for the winter retreat. This year for the winter retreat, usually at the winter retreat time, we start to learn some of the chants, maybe that we don't do so much during the year. Last year we started doing the Anuttalakkhana Sutta, and I haven't done it since, I don't think, since the end of the last winter retreat, maybe a couple of times. So making some effort to, for those of you interested, to learn some chanting as well during the winter retreat. Now, Lumpur will come back at the beginning of February, be back to do Marga Puja for us, and then he'll be doing some teaching, giving some talks and doing some teaching for the juniors. And there'll be talks and that through the winter retreat evening talks. And at the end of winter retreat, we'll have another short period of the group practice again. This is the sort of standard for the winter retreats here. So I'm very grateful for the lay group that have come to support us, the lay support group, doing a lot and taking away a lot of the responsibility for running the monastery away from the monks and the nuns. And the Garikas and the novices, and this allows us this space, this time, for this more contemplative approach to life, letting go of some of the business, if not all of it, that the monastics are usually involved in. So using this opportunity then to contemplate the mind, to develop meditation, to learn chanting, and to learn some of these reflections so that you can use them at all time. Once you learn some of these reflections, you can use them wherever you are, wherever you go, because they all point to the wholesomeness. One of the reflections I used was that when I was in Brazil, in Rio, 4 months, enjoyed my stay there. But at the weekend we used to do this, do the puja on Saturday afternoon and Sunday afternoon, and I had to get started with the precepts, and then I had to do a guided meditation. And I started to do this meditation that Ajahn Sumedho does of just wishing, having this sort of well-wishing, a sense of well-being, just bringing a sense of well-being up towards yourself. And I started to do that when I was there, and I found after I'd been there for a couple of months that started to work really well for me. It's just at the end of the meditation, when you do your meditation, however your meditation has been like, whatever it's been like, just stop the meditation and then just bring this sense of well-being towards yourself. And it's just like you just have that sense of well-being and a sense of contentment to how whatever the meditation was, however it was, okay, that's fine. Just a sense of contentment for that. But then as the meditation time finishes, and just sit in for a little while with this sense of well-being towards yourself, a sense of contentment, a sense of sort of happiness or friendliness towards yourself. And that's a good way to end the meditation sessions, especially if it's not been what you consider to be a particularly good meditation session. But however it's been, just end it with a few moments of this sense of having a well-being towards yourself, and a sense of friendliness, and a sense of contentment with the way things are. So I hope everyone that's here has a good winter retreat. I'd like to take the opportunity to say that. I hope you all have a good winter retreat, enjoy your winter retreat, and find this winter retreat very useful for yourselves and in your practice. And that goes, of course, for the lay people as well, or the lay group that's here. I hope you enjoy the time that you spend here with us in this winter retreat, and that you find it a very useful and pleasant time. I'd just like to express my gratitude for the fact that the lay people do come here and are willing to help to run the monastery and give us this space, this time, over this next 3 months. So that's enough for tonight.